Please be seated. Psalm 46 is one of my favorite psalms of all of the psalms. And it's a psalm that God has used to bring tremendous encouragement to people, God's people, and needed perspective to God's people for about 3,000 years. And when I read Psalm 46 and what's going on there in his life and what he knows God to be in the midst of it, my mind always rolls out to the people, God's people, who for 3,000 years have found themselves in just catastrophic conditions. And this psalm, God has made a friend to them. And that's what we want these songs to be, a friend to us. And they turn to Psalm 46 in order to receive God's comfort and to regain perspective. And Psalm 46 is a psalm that addresses life at its absolute worst on this fallen planet called planet Earth. And this world can be a very, very scary place, and it is a very, very scary place to live apart from God, that's for sure. Very scary place to live. In these days, everywhere you look in the world, what is it? Wars, rumors of wars. You look at terrorism, how rampant it is. You take a man who can take a knife in his hand and take another human being bound and blindfolded and cut his head off and videotape it and send it around the world. Monsters. That isn't religious zeal. That is a person who has seared even the conscience that every single person is born into this world with, whether they know God or not. That's demonic. You've got to have the devil himself or one of his fallen creatures inside of you to do that. That is so unlike Christ. It's so unlike God. It's such an affront to him and such a reproach to him. And here we are in a world where it's become a part of our vocabulary in the last 4 years or so. In a common word, terrorism, terrorists. Until the weird thing that can happen is I can go online and, you know, CNN or Fox News or whatever it might be to pick up the headlines for the day, and I can read about another, you know, 16 men from Thailand decapitated, or another bombing in Baghdad that blew 125 people in a million pieces, and I can read it and eat a piece of toast. But God, he never gets desensitized. He never gets so exposed to anything that he ceases to be appalled by how fallen this world is and how far it is from him today. And how in mass it turns in even greater numbers from him. As bad as it is, you'd think everyone would turn to him, turning in even greater numbers to run from him to make even a bigger mess than it is. And you look at what the world has become, and you look at the wars and the rumors of wars, and you look at the terrorism, and you look at it, and if we didn't have a Bible to go to, we wouldn't have anybody to say to us, that's not the way life should be. That's no way to live. You live in an insane asylum. This is crazy what we get used to every single day here. This is no way for the world to live, and it's no way for human beings to live. Then the world is armed to the teeth. Recently we've learned that North Korea has developed nuclear weapons, and a madman is at the head of that country. And then barring some kind of a change in course, Iran is not too far away from developing the fuel that's needed for them to develop nuclear weapons also. And you look around the world and you see the lawlessness, not in some, you know, frontier of wildness in the world, but in the United States too, and in Modesto too, where laws mean nothing to people anymore. Laws about property, laws about traffic, laws about treating one another as human beings. The laws are, they're viewed as optional by the culture. And lawlessness everywhere, crime, epidemic. I don't know, I guess somebody's got to get me something on new words to describe it. You use epidemic till epidemic doesn't mean anything anymore. And the gangs that grow bolder and bolder, and it's its own form of terrorism. It is an intent to destabilize a city or destabilize a nation or destabilize the world in order that I might interject my vision for the world on it. How bold everyone's become. It's fearless. Fearless. I pick up my newspaper this last week, and the news reported that an estimated 80 million people will die of AIDS in the continent of Africa in the next 20 years. 80 million people. How in the world do you even begin to get your mind around a number like that? Who can count to 80 million, let alone have every one of those numbers represent a human being that lives in the world today? I mean, where do you even start? And there's a very real sense in which, as I read the newspaper and as I watch the news or I listen to the news or I read the news online or whatever the source might be, I mean, you almost can't take it seriously and survive, maintain your mind. If I emotionally or mentally connected with the stories that I read in just one day on the condition of planet Earth, I'd go crazy. There's not enough reserve in a human being to handle one day's news on the face of this planet. Had an article this week that the Harvard AIDS researchers had come up with a new vaccine to fight the AIDS virus. And the AIDS virus effortlessly mutated and defeated it. It just blinked at it. Didn't even flex its strong right arm. It just pushed it right out of the way like it was nothing. And now we're hearing regularly, last few months, from the medical communities of the world, the warnings about the way that poultry is being farmed and handled in certain parts of the world, principally Asia. And these animals are just stuffed into these places, and it's not even a way for poultry to live. And the disease that's breaking out, and there's a particular virus that's come out as a most recent kind of strain, and it's a very scary virus to these medical professionals because it's leaped into the human beings now. And they look at it, and as they look at it in their thinking, it is not a matter of if we're going to have a pandemic again in human history. The question is, when is it going to happen, and what is going to launch it? And they're talking about a potential pandemic with this particular virus that could kill millions of people and tens of millions of people all over the world. There is not enough money in the whole world. There's not enough power in the whole world to fix the problems that this world faces as a result of turning from God and disregarding His word and His wisdom, His truth and His love. And on its current course, it will ultimately destabilize the entire earth. Even the most solid and stable of nations within our minds. And it's important for us to know that as God's people. What we live in and what we get used to is crazy. This is no way for people to live. And God knows it. And He never, praise the Lord, He never gets used to it. And He never gets conditioned by this world. And so He is able to come in and speak to us what we need to hear from Him to maintain perspective so that we don't call this home as Christians, but so that we don't also flip out as we watch it unravel before our eyes. I got saved in 1980. Immediately became a prophecy buff. I am seeing stuff today in terms of the whole prophetic element of things, talking about the world before the Lord comes back, that I never thought I would see. The stage is so completely set for that trump of God and Jesus coming back, taking us out of here, and then bringing an end to man's rebellion upon this planet. And He is coming back. And He's going to do that. So you've got these problems all over the world, but then we have our own lives to deal with. These catastrophic things that arise within our own lives. The health situations and the hospitals that some of us have to go to, and these tents that are, you know, failing us. And then some to be in a miserable, one-sided marriages. Because God isn't obeyed on the part of one of the partners. Then raising of difficult children and corporate restructuring, and it doesn't look like my job is going to survive this restructuring, and I'm just trying as hard as I can to pay the rent and keep that car running and where the gas prices are going to go, and then to put food on the table for my family. And until everywhere you look in life, to look near on the personal, to look far on the national and the international, all you see is instability. You just see uncertainty and the insecurity of life. And as we see all of it, we ask the same question that the psalmist does, and that is there a safe place to run to in this world? Is there a stable place to run to? In this world, something that's immovable, that'll be here today and it'll be here tomorrow and it'll be here the next day, and it won't collapse from under my feet. All you have to do is go through a divorce that you didn't want. Yeah, and everybody said, you know, it'll last forever, and I'll never, and I would never, and then the note, and there he is, he's gone or she's gone. Yeah, I'll never trust anyone the rest of my life. And in the middle of all of it, the head begins to spin, and you begin to say, is there a place of rest in this world? Something that's sure. And here the psalmist answers that question. And he writes this psalm in verses 2 and 3 at a time of, again, catastrophic upheaval in the world and in his world. Notice in verse 2 he says, though the earth be removed, and so the land is in upheaval. Verse 2, though the mountains be carried into the sea, and the idea is when you walk on planet earth, you say, you know, the two things that are immovable, the two sure things that are all around us is surely the ground that we walk on and the mountains. But he's in the middle of a situation where the ground that he walks on and the mountains, the things that you look at and you say, those will never move, that's forever, that'll outlive me, that'll outlive all of time. And yet circumstances rise up at this time in his life and history where even the surest things in life, all bets are off. He said what is surest in life is now shaking in upheaval. Verse 3. He said, though the waters roar and are troubled, and here he speaks of the sea, it's churning, it's foaming, and so often in the Bible, the seas are used as an image of the nations of the world, the people of the world, the foaming, the coming up against the, you know, the whole building up of all and everything. And that's what he looks at the world, all restless and unstable, the nations of the world. And then he speaks in verse 3, though the mountains shake with its swelling. Everything's dominated by what's happening in his life at this time. And then in verse 6, on top of all of it, the nations are raging. And he talks about war and he talks about violence. In the plural, he said, it's war and violence as far as the eye can see. As far as I can see, this place is crazy. And the whole world is shaking in the eyes of the psalmist. Nothing seems solid to him. Everything seems unstable and restless. And yet, it's at this time in his life. And so often it's the case in our lives too, that I then truly turn and appreciate God for who He is. Don't you hate yourself? I mean, what we are in the flesh. And have you ever had God just whoop you good? Go ahead and answer. Anybody else? Man, He whoops me. He just humbles me and breaks me and just crushes me, and it's all good thing, and you're just there and it just feels right and it is right, and I can say to the Lord, if I could just stay here, but I know all these things will start working in my life again and I'll get goofy again and you'll have to do this all over again. It's a longing of my heart to not have it, but we can grow. Here's this great God that we have, such a blessing God that we have in all, and we can get so used to Him. And then sometimes it takes something that happens in life to make me appreciate the relationship that sits when I worship the Lord. I can't keep my hands on my lap when I sing about His goodness. 2 weeks ago, I don't know if you sit and you might have just mouthed the words up on the screen. 2 weeks later, and that everything is engaged in the things of the Lord. Because we just get used. We get used to all these blessings. And we don't appreciate them the way, talk about the Lord, I don't appreciate them the way that I should. And then this thing hits. Say, Lord, thank you for who you are. Thank you for what you are. And that fresh appreciation for Him begins to fill our hearts. And he talks about what God is at times like this. Wouldn't it be terrible if He just painted this terrible picture and said, you're on your own? But in verse 1 and 7 and 11, He describes what God is to His people at times like this. And He said, our God is a refuge. He is our refuge. Verse 1, what is a refuge? It's a shelter. It's a place of safety. It's a place of sanity. It's a quiet place to go to in the middle of the craziness. It's a place to hide. It's a place where we come under His protection. And God knows that for us as His people in this world, He knows what's going on in this world. He knows what we face. He knows that in the middle of the battering of this world, in the middle of the warfare of this world, that every single one of us needs a refuge. And He is that to us. Jesus said, peace I leave with you, my peace I give to you. His peace He gives. He doesn't say, Damien Kyle's peace I give to you. Great. And He said, how peaceful is Jesus? I mean, you look at what He faced. And you never, he's never a nervous wreck in any of the Gospels. He just cuts a straight path right down through all of it, absolutely walking in peace. He said, "Peace I leave with you, my peace I give to you. Not as the world gives do I give to you. Let not your heart be troubled, neither let it be afraid." And then he says later also in John's Gospel, "These things I've spoken to you, that in me," not in me and $1 million and whatever, because there's no peace in God and $1 million. There's only peace in God. "These things I've spoken to you, that in me you may have peace. In the world you will have tribulation, but you be of good cheer. I have overcome the world." And Jesus knows that in order for a person to experience peace in the world, the source of my peace must be greater than all of the things that would rob me of my peace. And there's only one who is greater than that, and that's the Lord Himself. If you're looking for peace in anything other than God today, as a person that doesn't know Christ yet, or as a person who does know Christ, and you say, "Well, I'll get this and line this thing up over here, and this, and then we'll get, and that'll come, and then as soon as, then I'll have peace." You won't be any peace there in that, because you got the whole world of circumstances that's bigger than that, and any little twitch can bring the whole thing down. But God is bigger than everything. And so He can give us a peace because He's greater than all the things that would rob us of our peace. Notice He says in verse 1, "The Lord is our strength." He not only protects us, but He provides us with the strength that we need. You ever go through a situation in life, even as a Christian, and you say, I mean, the theologians can tear it apart, but we won't try to please them at the moment. But where you say, "I can't believe I got through that. I cannot believe that I got through that. I don't know where the strength came from," but we know where the strength comes from. And God takes in these different situations and He elevates whatever strength He's got to give of Himself to us to be able to, you know, to handle the situations. And so He gives us the strength that we need. And He knows man is in need. In this crazy world, he is in need of a strength beyond himself. And so He gives it. Notice He is the Lord of hosts in verses 7 and 11. That word host, it refers to angelic armies that are at the Lord's disposal. Sometimes all we see is the physical, just this gigantic thing, and we're so conscious, you know, of what's coming against us, and they have the power, and look at the army that they have, and we're completely overwhelmed by what we see in the physical. And what we don't know and lose sight of so often is that the fact of the matter is those who are with us are greater than those who are with them. You remember when the king of Syria, he was making war against Israel. And he brought his generals together and he said, "Listen, we need to go against Israel. Let's take our troops and we'll ambush them over here." And when they go over to ambush the armies of Israel would have already been tipped. They were already there and they would ambush the Syrians. And then they'd try and do it over here and do the same thing and end up ambushed and everything until finally the king of Syria pulls all of his generals together and says, "You know, who's the traitor here? Who's telling the enemy everything we're doing every time we go out there? They know ahead of time what we're doing. One of you guys have to be blabbing." And they said, no, it's not one of us. "There is a prophet in the land of Israel by the name of Elisha. And he knows what you say to your wife in your bedroom. He knows everything because God gives him the revelation." So the king of Syria, this is how wacky you can be. He decides, a guy like that, he's just going to go arrest him. So he sends an army to Dothan in order to arrest Elisha. And they come in, this giant army comes in the middle of the night with chariots. They surround the entire city. And then as Elisha's servant goes out to begin the day's chores or whatever, he goes outside and he looks up, and the whole city surrounded by chariots and surrounded by the army. And he comes back into Elisha, you know, he tells him about it. Alas, master, what shall we do? And Elisha said, listen, don't be afraid, because those who are with us are more than those with them. And he said, Lord, would you open up my servant's eyes to see the full picture here? And his eyes were opened, and he saw the armies of the Lord's host, angelic host, surrounding entirely the army that was there. There's a reality. There's a spiritual reality that is more real than the chairs that we sit in. And God is always working in that realm, always working there. He's in charge of the Lord's hosts. Remember when Jesus was, on the morning he was going to be crucified, he'd spent the night praying in the Garden of Gethsemane. And as he had prayed, Judas told the guys, you know, the one that I kiss, he's the one, go and arrest him. And Judas comes up and kisses Jesus. And Jesus says, betrayest thou the Son of God with a kiss? And they grab Jesus and they begin to arrest him. And Peter grabs a sword, a fisherman with a sword, And he just starts swinging all over the place, I guess, or whatever. The best he could do was take an ear off a servant of the high priest. Just flop right in the dirt. And Jesus has to take and heal the guy of his ear and everything. And he spoke to Peter, and he said, Peter, put your sword away. Those who live by the sword, they die by the sword. He said, don't you understand that I could, in a moment in time, call and have 12 legions of angels here? Legion is 6,000. He said, don't you know, with a word, 72,000 angels, I don't know where they would fit in the Garden of Gethsemane, could be here. Peter, relax. I'm not in trouble here. Everything's under control. It just didn't look like it in the physical, but it was under control. You notice in verse 7 and 11, he's described as the God of Jacob. What does that mean? God, this speaks of the fact that God is a covenant God, and God is a covenant-keeping God. God had made promises to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. And every single promise that he made to them, he was going to keep those promises. Related to Jerusalem, related to what they were facing at that time, related to the promises that we have in the New Testament. God doesn't make promises just to make promises. He makes promises and he is fully intent upon keeping them. And not only fully intent upon keeping them, he will never not keep them. You ever had a promise in his word that you thought, oh boy, Lord, it's so sad that your Bible would be disproved through my life. I'm so ashamed. Because that's not going to happen. You've let this thing go too far. It's too big of a mess. And your words isn't going to have the final say on it. Then what happens? Just wait a little longer. And every single thing that he's promised happens. I got saved in 1980. So I've walked with him for 25 years. And I have never, when he's given enough time to finish what he does, I have never known a situation except that his word had the final say in the situation. And he doesn't even have to break a sweat to do it. It's just the way that it is. And here, the psalmist is just encouraging himself. This God doesn't just make promises. He keeps his promises. And he has. He has related to our lives. One of the things that God did with the children of Israel continually in the Old Testament, he was always setting these things up to remind them of things so that they would remember the testimony of what God had done in their lives. You ever hit a trial and it's like the first one you ever hit, though you've got a history of 25 years with God? And God is always reminding us Remember when I took you through this, and remember this, and sometimes you can walk with the Lord for a longer period of time, and something is undoing me, and I face way harder trials at the beginning of my Christian life, but I forget about it. And so he's reminding them here of the fact God keeps his promises. And then notice in verse 1 and then in verses 4 and 5, he is a very present help in trouble. And the word present, it means a couple things, but one of the things it means, it's accessible. He is an accessible help. I never get put on hold by him. I never hit his secretary. Never. I never have to schedule an appointment. Anytime, any place on planet Earth, I just start to talk with him because he is present, always, always actively present in our lives. Remember when the writer of the book of Hebrews said concerning the Lord and the Lord speaking to us? He said, I'll never leave you or forsake you. Now that verse, kind of reading through the Bible in the course of the year, you hit that verse that morning, and everything's going great for you. I mean, everything's coming up roses for me and my gal. It's just fabulous. You just look at that and say, that's nice, you know. They ought to make a plaque out of that verse. That's a good one. And then one day, you hit that verse, and your whole world is going up in flames. And now it hits you a completely different way. The promise of God's presence, I'll never leave you or forsake you. Lo, I'm with you always, Jesus said, even to the end of the age. It's a fabulous consciousness in life. And it's one of the things I love about Psalm 46 is that constant reminder, he's always with me. He's a very present help. He's with me. And there are times in life where we need to be especially reminded of that. Every once in a while, when you know someone is going to be with the Lord in the fellowship or maybe outside of the fellowship, and you know sometimes those last few days, everybody knows if the Lord doesn't do a miraculous healing here, this person's going to slip on home into heaven. And maybe a couple, 3 days prior, they're kind of in and out of consciousness, and then last day or so, completely gone in terms of what we can understand. And sometimes a family will invite me in or something like that and bring a Bible, and I just start to read through the Bible. Start to read different psalms. And I'll always read Psalm 46. Because you never know who's hearing what. And the reason that I read Psalm 46 is the reassurance that God is present with me in the middle of what I'm in the middle of. And I'm talking about the person that's in that place. That's what I'd want somebody to do for me in that place. Just read the scripture. Just remind me how great my God is, how present he is, how good he is, how much he loves me, how worthy of my trust that he is. But he's not only present. Verse 1 tells us he's present to help in trouble. And the word trouble means in tight places. And it means in distress, a constricted feeling. I remember when I was younger, I used to be able to go under the house, you know, and you'd have to exhale to get under the beam, you know, to get the wire over to this place, and then you'd get, you know, the floor, whatever, and then you'd, okay, breathe back in, and you'd make your way across that. Now I'm older, man, it's just like, no way. I'll do without whatever is on that. You get in those tight places, you you're just looking at the hole that leads to under the house, and you start to. But there are places in life where, and what he's talking about is when the whole weight of the world is on you, I mean, the whole pressure of the world seems to be on me, and the reminder that He's with me at times like that, and to be able to rest in His presence when I'm in the middle of those kind of situations. And notice in verse 4 and 5, He says that God will help us at just the right moment. You ever thought God was late? Something in your life? I thought He was late quite a few times. Do you ever notice that God kind of ignores your counsel on His timing? I hope He does, because I like the comfort of that. God, whenever I come to God and say, Lord, listen, I just want to make you aware of two or three things that you're obviously missing here. And God says, hold that thought, Kyle. Let me get a pad and pencil. You always come up with some pretty good stuff. Now, He never does that. He never, ever does that. And again, I say, from 25 years of walking with Him, I've never known Him to be late. But by the time the whole thing plays out and everything, the timing is always... Because He's working not only to get me through the situation, but He's always knocking about five or six things out at the same time. So He's developing some character in my life, and He's also developing the relationship that I have with Him in the middle of all of it. And this situation, I mean, a lot of people think that this Psalm 46 was written about the time the Assyrians attacked the city of Jerusalem. And the Assyrians were under a king by the name of Sennacherib. And Sennacherib came and he laid siege to the city of Jerusalem. And he came with 185,000 of the fiercest, wildest, battle-hardened men in the ancient world at that time. And the Assyrians, talking about ancient Assyrians, if you're Assyrian today and you're saved, we won't hold this against you. But the ancient Assyrians, they were so cruel that when they, to make an example of a city that would resist their conquest, they would go in and conquer the city, kill everybody in it, and they would skin the people alive and cover the walls of the city with human skin. And then take the heads of everyone within the city, pile them in heaps at the city gates as a warning to the rest of the nations and cities not to resist them. There's nothing new under the sun. And these are the 185,000 men that have come to conquer Israel and come to conquer Jerusalem. And Jerusalem is guilty of resisting them. If they breach this wall, if they get into the city of Jerusalem, it's going to be a massacre. That's what they're in the middle of, and they know it. And then one night, God looks at that 185,000, and He's not a wreck at all. He's not, no medication for it, anxiety or anything in His life. And He sends an angel out, just a regular angel, not angel, Bartholomew or some kind of, Fauntleroy or some, kind of highfalutin angel. He just sends out a regular old angel, Angel Mike or Angel Dan or something like that. And that angel goes out, and before the night is over, 185,000 frontline Assyrian troops lie in their own blood. He wipes them out. And that's why when He says, just at the break of dawn, just when it looked like there was no hope, and I'm inclined to believe that they had masked for the attack that morning, and God said, no more. And He brought it to an end. And so the Lord, He knows how to help us just at the right time. And just when things are at their darkest, we say, oh, that's it. Just start planning my whatever and everything. God knows that we need help, and He knows how to provide it at just the right time. He's never late. I've never known Him to be late. after I've seen what he's doing. You ever see that bumper, that license plate holder? It's mostly women who buy them. And the, I'm not saying it's a reflection, but there's a license plate holder that I notice. I read licenses and license plate holder and bumper stickers and stuff like that. What else are you going to do? There's 60 cars in line to the stop sign and welcome to Modesto. Okay, we don't need to go there. But you sit there, and it says, always late, but worth the wait. And if I will pull up around them on a road or something, and just if it's a guy too, I'm not checking anybody out or anything. So just look. So I just want to see what pure egoism looks like in another human being. And he just look at it and say, I don't think so. I don't think you bought that. Nobody bought that for you. You bought that for yourself. But the Lord, he's never, ever, ever is he late. And he's always worth the wait. And you let that minister to your heart this morning. If you find yourself in that place, he'll do whatever he needs to do to be faithful to his covenant, to his word. And then finally notice, because of all of this, we don't need to fear. He says, verse 2, we will not fear. He's greater than every natural catastrophe. He's greater than every international and national problem. He's greater than every kind of personal thing that we face. And as the psalmist says in verse 50, because God is in the midst of her, she shall not be moved. Why was Jerusalem not moved? Because it was a city greater than other cities? No, because God lived there. You're just not going to burglarize God's house. It's just not going to happen. And the amazing thing is you take it into the new covenant, and we're God's house, temple of the Holy Spirit. These things are going to rise up and conquer what it is that he's doing in our lives. So every one of us as Christians, we can look and say the same thing in our heart. God lives here, and I shall not be moved. And that's the truth about the situation. And that's how it will play out. I'll readily confess to you that every second I have spent worrying in my Christian life has been a complete waste of time once I saw what it is that he was doing. One day, verses 8 and 9, God's going to bring this whole insanity of sinful man, he's going to bring it all to an end. He's going to come back, he's going to take his church out of here, he's going to judge this world, he's going to bring an end to the rebellion. He's going to establish his kingdom. That's what he's going to do. That's what he's going to do. All of the wars, all of the pride, all of the violence, all of the oppression, all of the rebellion, all of those things are going to be brought to an end. And when the whole world is swirling around us, that's something that we need to know also. He's coming back. He's coming back for us. And in the meantime, as we're waiting for his return, remember Jesus, as he said, you see these things and the stars and all of the distress of nations with perplexity and all. He said, when you begin to see these things, he said, look up, your redemption draws nigh. I'm looking up so much for his return. At just the right time, he's coming back to deliver us into heaven. And in the meantime, what do we do? And I close with this, verse 10. He says, be still and know that I'm God. The word still, it means to be relaxed. Relaxed? Are you kidding? How can I be relaxed? He says, just relax. Just take a deep Jack LaLanne breath, the mighty Wurlitzer, exhale. Just relax. Even in the midst of this, you know, catastrophe and all the stuff that's going on. And that word still, it has another interesting angle to it, not only to be relaxed, but it also can be translated to release, to take my hands off. And we will never know peace as long as we're still convinced that we know more than God concerning what's best for us. And when we look and we come up with our plan and we say, this is what should be done, and if he would just do this, and then if this happened, I know that everything will be great, and we come up with the greatest plan that we can have for our lives, and God says, his plan, infinitely superior. Infinitely superior. Can't compare to what God has planned. And this morning, will you accept that as a fact concerning the situation that's going on in your life? Will you accept the fact that he knows what he's doing and he loves you so much and he's so smart that in this situation that looks like the end of the world for you, and you think it ought to go this way and it's not, and you're sinking under the weight of it, that what he has in mind is infinitely superior, and then to surrender to that, to surrender the situation to him. Lord, I take this thing and I surrender it to your sovereignty, to your almightiness. I surrender it to your wisdom. I surrender it to your love. I surrender it to your goodness. And it's as I surrender it to him, half of the thing is we're fighting him, and that's the absence of peace, not the condition of the world. We're fighting the one we should be finding peace in. And then to just stop and say, I surrender it to you. Thy will be done in this situation and on earth, even as it's currently being done in heaven. Now you define it, God, and you back off from it. And he'll be faithful to do what needs to be done in that situation, and it will be infinitely better than what any of us could come up with. He said, be still. How can I be still? Because God says, and know that I am God. Why can I be still as a child of God? Because my God is God. God says, I'm God. Not the Assyrians, not the nations of the world, not their army, not, you know, your body, and not your, this virus, and not the doctors, and not your husband, and not your wife. It doesn't depend on any of those things. I'm God. I'm God. I'm good at it. There's nothing, no one compares to me. I'm God. I'm in control of everything. Nothing's outside of my control. You can relax because of my heart toward you. I'm God. I'm gonna take care of you. That's something to take a walk with. These things that we carry into church service today, and they're burying us. And Peter said, casting all of our cares on him because he cares for us. And just to take a walk or just to sit down someplace and not get up or not stop walking until that thing is completely on his lap. It's yours. You're God. What am I trying to do your job for you? I honor you. You're God. And I give you that situation. And I'm going to relax now and rest in you while you do what you're going to do anyway. So why don't I just relax along the way? And then God is there to rest in, and he wants us to rest in him today. Everything's under control. It's all under control. When he looks at our lives, he's not panicked. He's not a nervous wreck at all. Completely at peace. He knows that what he's going to do in our lives. We have a big God. So let's go to him as a refuge. And let's go to him for strength, and let's enjoy his presence within our lives when the whole thing is going crazy all around us. During the Reformation, there were times where things looked very, very iffy for Martin Luther and all, and he wrote A Mighty Fortress Is Our God from Psalm 46. And when things hit their lowest over and over again during the Reformation, he would turn to the men who were with him and they would sing Psalm 46 over and over again. And that's where a mighty fortress is our God came from. A mighty, and you read it all the way through, you can just see it. A mighty fortress is our God. A bulwark never failing. Our helper, he amid the flood of mortal ills prevailing. And it's always true. Because he is God, and because he is so smart, and he is so powerful, and because he loves us the way that he does, he wants to be our place of rest in the midst of the craziness. And because he is those things, we can rest in him. Let's pray together. Lord, thank you for this psalm. And here we add ourselves to thousands of years of people that have turned to this, Bible studies here and there, and mornings and evening services, and people singing and on their lap in their beds and all these different places. And we thank you for this word of yours, the truth, Lord, about you. And what a joy it is to walk in the peace that comes with just surrender to you. Lord, so often it's not the condition of the world, it's our fighting against you that causes the greatest turmoil within our life. And we lose you as the one to rest in the midst of all of it, and you want us to rest in you. And I just pray you take this passage and minister to our hearts related to that. Thank you that you are the God that you are to us. Thank you for your faithfulness to your word. Thank you for your goodness to us in every way. We just honor you in this place today. We honor you as our God. We honor you, Lord, for who you are. We are thankful for you. We're thankful to know you and to be your children. And we thank you in Jesus' name. Amen.